This podcast was specifically created for distress and crisis Ontario organizations and their volunteer responders to provide training and educational assistance on a variety of topics. As information evolves and changes, these podcasts are meant to offer ongoing support with the goal of updating them on an ongoing basis. We thank the volunteer responders and the contributors to this podcast. Please visit our website, dcontario.org, for more information and how to access free mental health services. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Yvette Perrault. I'm the director of the AIDS Bereavement and Resiliency Program of Ontario. I'm here to spend some time with you today talking about when grief comes to work. It's a session for supervisors and managers. I want to let you know how we think about loss. We understand loss as potential, not as pathology. We also understand that our objectives in this work for our taking care of our staff are to decrease people's isolation when they're experiencing grief and to increase people's choices when they're responding to loss. Our goal is to keep workers fresh. Our goal is to keep workers creative. Our goal is to foster mutual support in a workplace and to keep workers well over the long haul. It's our belief that responding effectively to grief in the workplace is an effective management strategy, but we also know that in the management literature, grief and loss is not really talked about. Correspondingly, in grief and loss, people don't talk about managing in the workplace, and we think this is a gap. We understand that death and loss from a variety of sources are going to affect every working person at some time in their lives, which means that if you're managing workers, and that's staff and volunteers, you're going to be managing grief in the workplace, probably without a whole lot of training to be able to do this. We know that grief impacts the workplace. This is some of the information from our studies. Absenteeism, illness, or high turnover, or an inability for people to take time off. They've got 9 days of overtime, 6 weeks of holiday time, and people aren't able to take a break from the work. We also see a decrease in productivity. We see irritability, emotional outbursts, unpredictable results on the job, a lack of confidence. Workers who were once really effective suddenly have diminished capacity. We also see people with an inability to set limits. So when some of the issues are boundaries, this is one of the effects that we see, is people don't know their own limits anymore. And poor morale, flatness, a lack of creativity, and that's going to mean increased costs for you. Premiums for benefits, a turnover, bringing new staff into the workplace. We also think there's opportunities connected to managing grief well in the workplace. That sets a culture of caring for workers. And if that becomes part of your reputation, this is a workplace that takes really good care of its staff and volunteers. That can serve you well. It's a place where people want to work. It also is an opportunity to say to people, as we expect you to take care of the people who call, the people who come to us for service, we will take care of you in that way. And it isn't just policy. It's how we relate to you with respect and with a sense of being genuine about it. Loss shows up in the workplace in three ways. So imagine these are three balls that you're juggling. One of them is when grief comes to work in a personal nature. So that's a worker who's had a death in their family, a traumatic event in their life, a divorce, a separation, an ill parent that they're taking care of. So they're going to come to work with that energy and with that stress. The second way that grief comes to work is when you have death in the workplace. So that could be the death of a client. That could also be the death or illness of a coworker. That could also be a traumatic life event. So loss isn't just connected to death. It's also connected to significant transitions in people's lives. The third way that loss comes to work is when there's a change in the workplace. So that will be downsizing, mergers, programs closing, loss of funding, or amalgamations. And what we see is people can hold steady with those first two balls if the third ball, the container of the workplace, holds steady. But when there's sudden changes in the container, then these other balls that you're trying to juggle end up starting to create some difficulties for people. What I expect as managers is that those three balls are in your workplace all the time, and you've already got a way of juggling those. This conversation is about how can I do that a little more consciously and maybe with a little less stress. I think these things are complicated, but they're not impossible to integrate. So what I want to bring you are a couple of things, some key underpinnings about how we understand loss. And that's just going to help you with your assessment, and then some ideas for how you can manage loss at work, both personally and then within your teams. We want you to think about how you conceptualize loss. Because loss is generally not part of our management training, it becomes something that people have assumptions about based on your own frame of reference. So that's what we're going to look at first, is how do you conceptualize loss? The first thing I want to talk about is attachment and loss. Why will grief show up at work? Because the people that you have on staff or as volunteers have attached to something and then have lost that, or that's been a significant change. We think of attachment as a gift, particularly when you're doing human service work where you want people to have an empathic response on the phone, you want them to listen well, you want them to listen with their heads and with their hearts. So, attachment for us is not a problem. Grief is the flip side of attachment. I've attached to something and it's changed and I'm mourning. When I did my training as a psychiatric nurse many years ago, what we were taught was professional distance and objectivity. Step away from your attachments. I have a nurse's heart. That's all about attachment. So the idea of stepping away from attachment created real challenges for me as a young nurse. And I think that's important to recognize. In human service work, people do get attached. As managers, it's our responsibility to help people recognize that, what's an appropriate attachment, and how do we help people detach well so that they can move on. So we don't see grief as a problem. We see it as a process that we can help people with. And if you expect people to have a genuine caring response in the work, they are going to make connections, they will suffer losses, and they will have a grief response. It's not a problem and it's not a personal failing. I want a big appreciation for workers in this conversation that we understand that the ability of people to have a compassionate response, the ways that people connect, are also the very same ways that cause people to suffer when there's been a loss or when there's been a significant change or when there's been a death. So what makes people good at what they do is also the place that they may be wounded in the work. And for us to have a soft appreciation as managers about that. You can't say to people, I want this, but I'm not prepared to deal with this. So some truisms about grief. We attach, we lose, we will mourn. So grief is natural, it's normal, but it's also disruptive and it's traumatic, and we can't forget those last two parts. Grief has no timetable. So what that means is a current loss in the workplace can often generate other losses, resurrect other losses for people, and people can feel a little crazy about, so this old woman died, why am I having nightmares about my mother or my grandmother? So we need to help people connect the dots. It may not be this loss, what are the other losses in your life? But loss also isn't a linear process. Many of us have seen the charts that show loss as a journey that looks like this. And what we can say to people, it's more of a spiral. So you're going to be hitting a spot here, hitting a spot here, hitting a spot here, and then back up here. And no, you're not going backwards, right? The motion is still forwards. And that grief affects us on a holistic level. We tend to have this idea that grief is about sorrow. So when we see people crying, we go, oh, you're having a grief response. We tend not to recognize it when it's anger or it's fear or it's numbness where people disconnect. We also don't recognize it when people are emotionally okay, but they're mentally confused, ditzy, don't know why they're in the room, don't know what this meeting is about. So the disorientation in the mental quadrant. Or the physical quadrant, emotionally okay, can get to the meetings, but my body aches. I'm sick all the time. I have a headache that doesn't go away. I get every flu that's going around. Or the spiritual effects of loss, which we see as meaninglessness. Why are we trying? Nothing we do makes a difference. There's a quality of despair and a lack of creativity and hopelessness. And I think that's really difficult for people to say, I'm in spiritual distress. You know, we can acknowledge some of the ways that people respond, but spiritual distress is tough for the people that I work with. So generally, when we talk about this pattern of moving through loss, we recognize that when people have had a loss, there's going to be a period of shock, disorientation, maybe a little numbness, and then some emotional expression, which can come out as anger or rage, right? Maybe sadness, maybe anxiety. And then people move through a time of missing, just missing. That's the period of, I understand that that person is dead. I understand that they're not coming back, and I'm really sad or upset about that. And then people have to make their way through life without that person that they're attached to or that place or thing that they're attached to. We call that reorganization. How are we going to reorganize around the loss? And then there's a period of reinvestment where I'm going to move forward in life. I'm going to build a legacy, but I'm going to choose to invest my energy in other places. So it's really, you know, that simple language, and it's a very complicated experience when you're in it. The first response we see, the most common response, and you will see this in the workplace, is avoidance. And that's the pushback that goes, I don't want this to be true. Or this is a can of worms, don't open this up. So there you are as a manager sitting with somebody saying, I understand that your spouse or your child or your mother has just died. How are you doing? And the response you get is, don't open that up. I wrapped that up this morning. I don't want to talk about that here. And I think that's a fair response, is these are protective coping mechanisms that people have. And I think that's important to celebrate, to recognize, and to say, if you want to have a deeper conversation, I'm available to you. What can we do practically to help you with an accommodation in the work so that you can feel productive at work? The other thing that's important to know about grief is, there are patterns of response. Mostly we recognize a grief response when it's in the emotional and spiritual quadrants, when people have access to their feelings, when they want to light a candle, when they want to tell a story, where there's some sense of memorializing. I think our grief groups that are set up by places like Bereaved Families of Ontario are a really good example of responding to people who have what we call an intuitive response to grief. I feel my feelings, I tell the story, I make meaning. And it's better if I do that in a group of people, because I like hearing other people's stories. On the other hand, you've got people we call instrumental grievers that I don't think our society does so well by. These are the people who are physical and mental. So I'll tell a little story. My father's a carpenter, and when his mother died, my grandmother, my father didn't sit in the house and tell stories about grandma. He went outside and built a garage in 4 days. That's an instrumental griever. He's not going to sit in a therapy group, my dad, but he is going to have the energy of his sorrow move through his body with a hammer, and he's going to construct something. So I think when we're looking at people who have an instrumental style of grieving, it's harder for them because they're not an easy fit in the ways that we've constructed talk therapy or support groups. These are the people who need a jogging group or a carpentry group or a come and make lawn ornaments in the memory of somebody, like actual physical construct. They also need some really good, go read a good book. It's going to help you mentally to actually know that there's a process here. Some things important to know if you've got a worker who's dealing with a grief response is what we call determinants of grief. So who was that person and what was the nature of the attachment? It's easy when it's, that's my mother who died, that's my child who died. It's more complicated if it's an ambivalent or complex relationship. What is the nature of attachment? And how did the person die? Was it deemed natural? Was it deemed accidental? Was it suicidal? Or was it a homicide? And there's very different characteristics for how people are going to react to that. And you think about the marginalization and the secrecy if it's something like a suicide. You know, I can't talk about that out loud. Where is the location, the physical location? So if you think about this in the workplace, if you've got policies that say we have 3 days bereavement leave if you have a family member that dies, and the mother that has died is in a remote village in Bangladesh it's going to take a week to get to, how do your policies actually support somebody in taking the time that they're going to need? So that's a very real question. We have to make assumptions that not everybody's significant other is going to be a plane trip, you know, to Ottawa or to Winnipeg. How has the person grieved past losses? If they've had a rough ride when they were younger, I would want to know that if that's my staff, because this time may be rough and I need to be prepared to support that. And then the social variables, cultural, ethnic, religious, subcultures, rituals, what's appropriate for you. Another piece of theory I found incredibly helpful as a manager is the notion that time heals all wounds. Have you heard that? Time heals all wounds. So there's a sense that we go forward in time, our loss is behind us, and the pain of loss decreases as we move forward. That's actually not true. There is a phenomenon called STUGS, and this is in the clinical literature, sudden, temporary upsurges of grief, STUGS, that say that as you move through time, there'll be a reminder, an anniversary. There'll be the first Christmas without the person you love, the first holiday, the first significant milestone in a family life, a grandchild that's born and your mother's not there. That can create a STUG, which is a sudden temporary upsurge of grief. It's as intense as early on in the loss, but the duration is less. It doesn't last as long. People can think they're crazy. I'm not going forward. I am feeling bad about myself. So I think it's very important when we're doing grief education in the workplace that we tell the truth about what the trajectory of grief looks like. Now, I just want to very quickly mention three other ways that we see loss showing up in workers, just for you to develop a vocabulary. These are distinct from multiple loss responses, but I see workers using the terms interchangeably. So stress-related responses of workers, I've talked about grief and loss, but it also includes things like compassion fatigue, vicarious trauma, and burnout. So I want to make a quick distinction between those three. So compassion fatigue, you think about the volunteer who's been on the lines for, you know, 100 years and keeps coming back every Thursday to do their shift. Compassion fatigue is a phenomenon where you just simply don't have gas in the tank. This is a person who is no longer able to feel the kind of empathy and responsiveness that you're used to. And it's just wearing down. Somebody is just exhausted. It's been described by Charles Figley as the cost of caring for others in emotional pain. And any of you who've been on the front lines for a really long time, you know what that feels like, which is, you know, I can't read the paper one more day and take in the pain of the world because I don't have any capacity to do that. Vicarious trauma is when people have heard so many traumatic stories that their worldview shifts. So their worldview, which was a world that encompassed kindness and love and gentleness, suddenly becomes a worldview that says the world is mean and hostile and not safe. I'm not going to let my kids go outside anymore. That's a shift in worldview. The trauma of other people has now become the trauma of the workers. That takes more intervention to deal with when somebody is dealing with trauma that keeps surfacing, nightmares that keep happening, but it's not actually from their own lived experience. The third one is burnout. And people use a term, oh, you're so burnt out. Generally, that means workers who are having low job satisfaction, and either the workload is overwhelming or their satisfaction in the work is done, right? They need a job change or they need help leaving well, right? The burnout is, I just don't have the creative juices for this work anymore, right? It's not connected to trauma. It's not connected to loss. It actually has to do with the structure of the work. The organizational effects. So here you are in the workplace juggling these three balls, and then you've also got vicarious trauma, burnout, and compassion fatigue. You're a busy manager. The workplace can feel like a kettle with the heat turned on with a cork stuck in the kettle. The image of that for me is we don't have control over that heat, those of us who are frontline human service workers, right? That's somebody else's hand on the dial. But we do have control over that cork in the kettle. And I think capacity in the workplace is you can feel when things get heated up in a workplace. The steam needs to come out of the kettle. How do we help workers get that cork out, debrief accurately, adequately, so that they can start to refuel and regenerate. And then at the end of the day, we put the cork back in the kettle so they can get their jobs done. But I think when we're looking at grief and loss in the workplace, we're actually looking at cork management in the kettle. So how can you support individuals? You can appreciate that loss responses are unique. People are going to have different ways of approaching their loss, but there are certain phases that are important for you to be familiar with. Understand that loss response takes time. Somebody comes back from the funeral for their dead partner, that doesn't mean that their grief is over. In fact, their grief has probably just begun, right? The busyness of the funeral has taken their attention. Now they're going to live into life without their partner. When people do grief work well, significant personal transformation can come. When people have a sense of what meaning did that attachment have, and how am I going to live bigger as a result of this love and this loss. So you may expect we can protect the worker and they're going to be able to come back and be the same as they were before. My experience is if it's been a big change, people want more. And that's either going to be a conversation about, let's help you leave well so you can go back to school and get another degree and sing. Or let's readjust your job so you can sink your teeth into something. My experience is people are not the same and what they want isn't the same. I also think that you get more impact out of this if you can foster discussions about grief and loss in teams and not just do this work individually, because the team builds a capacity then, and then people can provide mutual support to each other, which I think is less stressful for us as managers when a team can self-manage around loss. The power of presence. Be there. I often have managers who say, I'm not a counselor, I don't know what to say. And what I say to you is, you get into somebody's office or you send a card and you do the best you can with a response that says, I know something significant has happened here. I hope that you get the support that you need. I am here if there's anything practical I can offer. You know, get in there and be genuine. Don't say things like call anytime if you don't want a phone call at 4 a.m. Okay, because grieving people will think you're serious, right? And that's when they're going to need you. What message you're communicating as a manager is, we and I care about you as a person having a difficult time. The other caveat I would add is to encourage people to express themselves openly in an environment that doesn't support open communication is a setup for people. So don't say, come and talk about this in the team meeting. If nobody else has ever talked about grief and loss, and people talking about emotions is just not done in your workplace, right? So it's important to not set people up in a culture, that organizational culture, that may not support their vulnerability. I want to say one thing about organizational transition, because I talked about that as the third ball. What we know as managers, when we talk about organizational change, we tend to talk about it as we are making a change. We've got a new program, we're merging with another organization, and our tendency as managers is to stand on the hill and say, come here, it's going to be great. We've got a new strategic direction, these are our plans. I think what we need to understand is for workers, we have to help them create an ending. We have to help them understand what is going to be complete, what will be no more, and then help them be in a grief process around that in order for them to make the journey up the hill to be where you are. In many workplaces, I hear people talk about resistance to change, and how I conceptualize it is workers haven't had a chance to actually let go of what was familiar to them and then reorient themselves to the new that we're asking them to move into. So the questions that we introduce around change is, what's lost? And help workers identify that and then help them mourn. What's left? What can they count on? I am still your manager. You're still going to have your colleagues to work with. It's going to be a new project, though. And then what's possible, which is the dreaming. It's not just about what we don't have. It's about what we're moving forward to. So those three questions have been extraordinarily helpful. What's lost? What's left? What's possible when you're managing organizational change? I would also suggest that you take a look at your policies and procedures in the workplace, particularly around loss, around stress leave, around bereavement leave. What have you got, and how flexible is it? Is it flexible enough to accommodate shifts in jobs or job sharing when people can't come back to work full time? Would it accommodate somebody who actually needs to spend a lot of time caring for a frail elderly parent and then going through the bereavement process when the parent dies? How broad are your policies? And what types of trainings are available? What we see is if you can bring grief and loss awareness into a workplace before there's traumatic events or before people are grieving, it helps build a conversation and help shift the organizational culture to say, we care about these things for ourselves too. And this is how we can create environments for mutual support. And then my other question is, where do you debrief? If you're suddenly becoming aware of these balls that you're juggling, then who's got your back and who's helping you unwind and understand, how am I handling these situations and am I doing a good job? So loss in the workplace, it impacts people. It's a philosophy of leadership. We handle loss well. It's a practice requiring a plan. And it's also about policies and procedures that are supported by an organizational culture. And I also want to say that you are an important resource and that your well-being matters.
Hi, I'm Damien, one of the editors of the DCO Learning Forms podcast. Over the past year, we've been busy converting our Learning Forms series of videos into podcasts and thinking of new ways to continue delivering new and more in-depth content. We've seen the demand, and we're announcing our move to Pinecast and our new tip jar function. Please consider going to tips.pinecast.com/jar/distress and crisis Ontario and donating. And in return, we'll be recording new follow-up episodes on some of our most popular topics. These will be accessible for tippers only and will help pay for travel, web hosting, etc. For the interim, you'll still be able to access existing content on both the Pinecast and Fireside feeds for free, but eventually we'll be making the switch to Pinecast. Thank you for your understanding.